This is a scientific apologetics session one, and it's an introduction. So we're basically looking at page one of 33. And, okay, if you can't hear me, just put your thumb up like that. And like I said, you could follow along with me in the outline.
We can't hear you.
You can. This is not the time for questions, no. Right, good. That's good. Yeah, anytime. Just throw the hand up. Throw something at me. If I catch it, I won't throw it back because I'm a Christian, so I'm just going to turn the other cheek. Okay? But I'll keep your stuff. No.
Donate to church.
That's right. yeah, just throw it up anytime. You can follow along with me in these notes if you want. You don't have to. The way this school likes to do it is they want to give you something at the end of the class to take home with you at the end of the course, and you could use it as like a manual. And if you never touch it for 5 years, you can come back to it in 5 years, and a lot will be there for you. You can add to it over the years, stuff like that. So the intention is that I give you everything I've got and hold nothing back, and that way you don't have to feverishly take notes and maybe lose track. So I've deliberately put everything in there, and that's what the head wanted me to do. So I've done it. Now, a lot of times it may sound like I'm reading stuff to you, but the goal here is that you have it already and you don't have to write it down. And if you don't want to look through it as I go through it, just look at me, because that's what you're paying me for, right? Okay, so any questions then before we get going? Other ones? Okay. So there have been a lot of recent claims at the popular level and at the academic level against Christianity. Christians hear claims like intelligent design is creationism. You've probably heard that. We hear claims like science has proven the Bible is wrong, or science has made Christianity irrelevant, or all that exists is that which can be perceived through the five senses and that which can be understood by scientific experiments. And I've actually heard this by a friend of mine who's an engineer. You've also heard, everyone knows we evolved. Get over your creationism. Darwinism is a fact of the universe. I've also heard this by another smart engineer. I'm an engineer myself. And some of these guys I work with are very brilliant. And so these statements, they're propagated from the highest academic level to the street level. And I've read these in books by brilliant professors, and I've read these in books by not-so-brilliant people, and heard them at birthday parties, heard them on the street, and so forth. So people say these things a lot. And recently, a famous evolutionary biologist, Richard Dawkins, you may have heard the name. He's author of a best-selling book called The God Delusion. He's an outspoken critic against Christianity, and sometimes he writes and speaks provocatively, and sometimes he's very angry when he writes and speaks. And so Christians kind of get freaked out. You know, they don't know what to do necessarily when they hear this. And as a scientist, Richard Dawkins bashes Christianity as a whole. And he doesn't really stick to his area of expertise all the time. He really starts getting into other areas besides evolutionary biology. But, you know, he's an outspoken critic, and he gets a lot of attention. And he's been dubbed by Christians one of the new atheists. And these Christian responders try to take on some of his more angry charges, and the not-so-angry ones, too. But it's the angry ones that really freak out Christians and send them home running. And so another Nobel Prize-winning physicist, Steven Weinberg, argues that science sets people free from religious, quote, superstition, that essentially all of Christianity is just a bunch of superstition, like not jumping or touching the foul line when the baseball player, you know, jumps over it to go running out to the outfield, because that will affect his next at-bat. Some superstitious kind of rule like that. This is just Christianity. He says, I think the world needs to wake up from its long nightmare of religious belief. And anything that we science can do to weaken the hold of religion should be done, and may in fact be our greatest contribution to civilization. They want to weaken the hold of religion on the public because they want to free us from our superstition. So how does the Christian respond? What does the Christian do? Do they freak out? Do we get afraid? What do we do? Well, what we could do, here's a possible scenario coming up of a way to possibly respond. Every year in February, there is an international day called Darwin Day, and it's basically the anniversary of Darwin's birthday and the origin of species. I guess they're both in February. And the day will be filled with all sorts of fun activities, such as lectures and conferences and birthday parties for Darwin all over the world. And you can find out more information if you want to attend one of these events at these websites. And this will be a very welcome celebration for advocates of Darwinism. This event definitely provokes advocates of Darwin to write blogs, speak out in the media, and bash Christians, telling them that their beliefs are pretty ridiculous. And they try to push Christians out of the public square, often on that day. And they do a good job. They push us out. And Christians aren't very capable at responding. And so then they say things like intelligent design is creationism and it's not science. And so so how does the Christian respond to this? Here are some possible responses. Just one second. Christians can use the day as an occasion to learn more about Darwinism, theories of micro and macro evolution, and research performed in, quote, intelligent design, in that movement, to raise awareness about these ideas and these areas of science to other Christians. That's a possible response, instead of just keeping the mouth shut. Another possible response is organize an International Intelligent Design Day to raise awareness of the results of scientific research in the fields of biochemistry, astrophysics that point to design. Now, here we've just thrown out the words intelligent design, so some of you may be like, hey, wait a minute, hold on, just hang tight for a sec. And so Christians can be very appalled at how what I'm calling the gatekeepers of scientific knowledge in the ivory towers of academia attempt and usually succeed in holding minds hostage to the naturalistic worldview. But Christians need to get their stuff together in order to respond right. Because, as it turns out, there are what I call gatekeepers of knowledge. These include those in the ivory towers of academia, influential academics and professors, heads of think tanks in Washington, D.C. usually, other sorts of Washington institutes, and influential authors. And these people usually define and decide what science is. And so Christians can be appalled and say, no, this is not right. Darwin, don't celebrate that. And they can get angry when and people say that intelligent design is just creationism disguised, and get fired up about that. But before we, you know, struggle with that idea, we have to sharpen our pencil as Christians. We have to figure some things out and get our head together on some stuff. And we need to think about how we disagree with those who don't hold the same worldview. In what respects do we differ with those who hold a naturalistic worldview? In what respects do we differ with those who say that science is the only source of knowledge in the universe? And we need to be able to respond well to these ideas. And so as Christians, we need to dig deeper. We have a lot of work to do. And the non-Christian needs us to do that. They need us to not give them a simplistic response. Those days are over. We've been pushed out of the public square because we pushed ourselves out, because we haven't been able to be thoughtful about current science and the current ideas that are going back and forth in the public square. So it's not all maybe they're pushing us. A lot of it's our timidity and our lack of trying. To the question.
Yeah, I want to go back to your characterization. That appeals to Plato, those who enjoy bashing Christians and pushing Christians out of the public square. And specifically, you mentioned Dr. Dawkins. It seems to me here you're referring to like an ad hominem attack. You say bashing Christians. Are you saying bashing them personally?
A lot of times, and I'm not saying that this doesn't happen. I'm not saying Christians don't try to bash them either. I'm just saying that a lot of times what Christians do is they fear a harsh response by a secular academic who holds to an atheistic worldview. And they freak out about that. And so they don't, it's almost like you're a child and an adult comes to you and says, "You're not doing it right. Put that down." And that child kind of freaks out and gets quiet. And so what I'm saying is that to them sounds like bashing. And a lot of times academics do speak harshly to each other, but they're so sophisticated and they do it so well, you know, almost in maybe in British accents, that we don't really pick up how strong of a ferocious attack it was, you know. So there's bashing happening, but it sounds very intellectual and lovely.
So the point is, it's verbal bashing, not physical bashing.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Well, oh, yeah, verbal. Usually, no. No, usually, you're yeah, good point.
Criticism of the beliefs themselves.
Correct, absolutely.
There's a difference between I'm bashing you, you're a bad person, and saying,
yes.
Well, these ideas are suspect and should be held up to evidence claims that they're based on a knowledge framework of the working of the universe.
Absolutely.
And an argument, you can peel off across those lines, and it does get very personal.
Yeah, usually it doesn't get personal if you're a respected professor that's been doing that debate for a while, and he knows how to continue to engage in that conversation. Some professors would, but we usually don't hear about those guys because they're not at the Richard Dawkins public level. And Richard Dawkins doesn't do that, at least not that I know of. He doesn't necessarily bash. Now, Christopher Hitchens, he'll bash somebody's idea, no problem. He'll say it's ridiculous, it's foolishness.
He did. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay,
yeah, and I've heard him do that too.
No, I'm saying he's dead. Past tense.
Oh, sorry. Yes. No. Yes, he's dead, not, and he did. He just passed away recently.
Right.
Last summer, I think. Something like that. And he was just ferocious in his attack to the Christian idea and worldview. And no, not necessarily to the Christian. I mean, he may say something like, "You're ridiculous, Mr. Christian, for believing that. You're ridiculous." Like, that's ad hominem attack. But that's probably as far as it would go. And I don't even know if he's done that. But he definitely bashes a worldview, no problem. Yes, hi.
Of
Christopher Hitchens is the one that passed away. And he kind of fits well in this new atheist label that Christians have put on these guys that are real ferocious in their criticism of Christianity. Yes. Yeah.
I've been trying to follow. I've been reading some of his stuff. So.
Hitchens or Hawken?
I didn't know who it was, but I love reading the arguments and
yeah.
Hitchens, Dawkins.
Yeah. Yeah, Christopher Hitchens passed away, unfortunately. He had some health issues, but he's written a lot, and you can read a lot of what he wrote online. If you just search the internet, his stuff is everywhere. But thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, I think that's the issue that I think we all have, you know what I mean? I'm a skeptic. And
okay.
Yeah. I'm an evidentialist and a materialist.
Not connected to the speaker.
No.
Not connected to the...
Right. Not personally connected to the speaker. So if we're going to be in the public square debating ideas, then absolutely the fundament of the ideas, the evidence for those ideas, is open to objective analysis and criticism on both sides.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that I'm going to go and tell someone they're a bad person for what they believe, or that they shouldn't raise their kids to believe or things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't want to facilitate or commend anybody or create an environment where people are bashing each other. In fact, it's exactly what you just said. There has to be civility in the public square, and we have to be able to engage with each other's ideas and know each other's ideas. And that's kind of the point of what I'm making is, Christians, we get quiet and timid. So, okay, if you're going to be quiet and timid, at least go do some homework and research some stuff. At least go figure out some things in your own, you know, bedroom and quiet time, so you can go back into the public square and ask some questions next time, and then go back and retreat again and learn some more, and then maybe you can offer maybe a suggestion like, hey, have you considered this, blah blah blah. And so there's a way to do it, and Christians, really, we suck at it. We're terrible. We suck at evangelism, which is what Jesus told us to do, but that's another topic, but we suck at engaging in ideas. Frankly, we do. We're terrible. We get emotional. Christians probably get much more emotional than any skeptic or atheist we're talking to in the street. It's so unfortunate. It's so unfortunate considering our intellectual heritage as Christians and how highly respected the Christian theologians were, but that's a whole other topic. Yes, sir?
Well, you kind of hit a point there that I was hoping to talk about. So often in the square and in dialogue, Christians spend so much time answering questions, and if they don't know the answer, they get frustrated.
Yeah.
Instead of having the ground to shoot holes in other people's theological canoes. You know, so someone goes, well, prove there's a God. Well, show me someone making a living self from inert material. They can't. We as Christians, and part of this, you know, is why I'm here is because I absolutely support what you're doing, but we need to ask questions also. When they say, well, we obviously came from monkeys. Well, show me, you know, if you've seen the Evidence for a Creator by Strobel, and he points out there's not just one missing link. There's half a dozen, and he actually identifies each one of them. So as Christians, we've got to spend less time really answering questions and answering questions and then start asking some of our own.
Yeah.
That's paramount.
That's right. Yeah, we definitely don't know the art of asking questions. That's for sure. So that was kind of the nature and the point of that. And a lot of what I'm throwing at you right now is to get you to just start processing stuff like this. Start thinking about things just to spark your interest. So let's see, where are we here? We need to ask ourselves as Christians, we're in the middle of page 3, can we learn more about the method of science? Can we learn more about the various theories of human origins that Christians hold to? Can I learn more about the philosophical presupposition of certain scientists and myself? How sophisticated or simple is my scientific understanding of the world? Christians in this room, you need to ask yourself those questions. How sophisticated or simple is your scientific understanding of the world? And we all in this room, Christian or not, can get a better and polished up understanding of science, scientific discoveries, and a scientific worldview. And we could all use a little academic honesty and confess that we're not the experts in everything, no matter how strongly or sincere we are, or how strongly we hold to our worldview, or how awesome we think our worldview is. But many people will still often claim that science is the expert on everything, meaning what I mean by that is it's the authority on everything. Many people claim that. And our current Western culture has lofted up science as the sole authority or the sole source of knowledge and truth. We've just put it on a pedestal. Christians and non-Christians, everybody. Science. That's what it is. It's not philosophy. It's not religion. We don't know what religion's false or true. They're all good religions. That's what we say. They're all good. And we don't know the meaning of life. We just look to, you know, whatever works best for you. That's your meaning in life. But science, what it tells us, we hold as certain. That's knowledge. That's true. I know that for sure because science told me. And Bertrand Russell, famous atheist in the last 50, 60 years, said, what science cannot tell us, man cannot know. So science is something that has just taken over, essentially, has its dominion, because we've put it there. We've given it that power as a society. And my question is, does science, if it holds that position in our world, does it rule out Christianity? Let's leave it up there as the authority. Does it rule out Christianity? Does it rule out Christian teaching, Christian doctrine? Is the physical world all there is, or is there more? We need to ask these questions, given that science holds this position. How are we to understand religion in a science-governed world? How do we understand religion in a science-governed world? How are we to understand the evolution versus intelligent design debate? How do we even begin to approach that? So these questions and others will be addressed in this class, and this is an opportunity for you to know how science and Christianity are compatible realms, and how scientific study can actually strengthen the faith for the Christian, and for the non-Christian, it can establish belief. It can establish belief. Just science alone can establish belief in Christianity, or that there is a God. I'm not saying it has to or it will, I'm just saying it can. And to do this, we must understand the philosophy of science and the results of current scientific research. We got a lot of homework to do. And so, like I said, just remember to relax in the class, and I know you may be, some of you may be wanting to throw out ideas and you don't like what I'm saying, or something's already not feeling right. That's okay, I just invite you to relax. And let me intro the class, and I think you'll be happy with the result. And by the way, this introduction will spill into the next week, and so it'll be a nice, you know, jump start to this class for you, because this is a big topic, so we need to really kind of create a nice framework and a nice foundation. So why study this stuff? Why get into scientific apologetics? First and foremost is because it matters to non-Christians. Science matters. It really is important to non-Christians, people that are not believers. Non-Christians hold science in a high regard. 84% say that science has had a positive impact on society. Of course. 70% say that scientists contribute to a lot of society. Yeah? 55% of the public sees science conflicting with religion. 55% of the public is a large number of people, of non-Christians. 55% will have an intellectual barrier to coming to faith in Jesus due to the idea that science conflicts with religion. Just due to science alone, someone's going to say, I have doubts. I have doubts. I cannot, will not, become a Christian or think God exists because of science alone. And so 55% of people are already predisposed to have doubts in God's existence, about God's existence, just because of science. So science is important for a non-Christian. They put a lot of weight to science. The Christians should too, but they definitely do. And reaching the non-Christian, if you're a Christian in this room and you want to reach a non-Christian, you need to know science. So it helps to remove what I call an intellectual barrier for a person coming to see or know God. It helps bring down that barrier. Now, the non-Christian, you know, is going to say, I don't have a barrier. You Christians are nuts for thinking I have a barrier. And that's fine. I'm nuts for sure. But this is important, because if someone says that God does not exist because of this science, then I'm just saying there's a separation there due to science. That's all I mean by that, really. Now, in terms of academic non-Christians, I'll tell you a story about a guy named Anthony Flew. Renowned atheist philosopher Anthony Flew. And in 1950, the young Flew wrote a philosophical paper called Theology and Falsification. Back then, he wrote on the idea that the burden of proof is on the theist to show that there is a God, and that each of us is to follow the evidence wherever it leads. And he's taken that from an old philosopher, I think Socrates. And this was reputedly one of the most frequently quoted philosophical publications of the second half of last century. It was a groundbreaking paper and the atheist Antony Flew was very young at the time. And since 1950, Flew and a few others have been proudly carrying the atheist philosophical torch. They have been regarded very highly in terms of philosophers of academia. And there's a picture of him there. He was an expert on the atheist philosopher David Hume. And in my college class on Hume, we had a textbook assigned, and it was written by Antony Flew, and I didn't know who he was at the time, but later on I found out how important of a figure he is. And in the academic community, he is regarded as one of the most brilliant minds, atheist minds, of our time. In the 80s, Flew began to start debating Christians. And he held debates here and there. And in each debate, Flew was so highly respected and regarded by his opponent. But he started to acknowledge in the 80s that science started to have something to it in terms of its argument for God. That he started to acknowledge the convincing scientific evidence that Christians have accumulated for their case for theism. He started to recognize the importance of this. And when I was in college, I saw Flew debate Gary Habermas, and that debate drew about 1,500 students. And they just came out in droves. And there's an excitement in the room. And these two were very relaxed. They were sitting in couch chairs on the stage. But people were very excited as they entered the building. And overflow rooms on campus had to be used. And it was quite an event, even though the two were very relaxed, because they knew about Flew. They knew how important he was in terms of his philosophy and contribution to the atheist worldview over the last 50 years. And there was no clear winner that day, as they were just discussing things. But over the last two decades, despite the astute and very rigorous philosophy that guided him for over 50 years as one of the world's leading atheists, the evidence from science began to win him over. And this is a very well-documented shift. He said, about 2005 or so, he said, "I think that the most impressive arguments for God's existence are those that are supported by recent scientific discoveries. And I've never been much impressed by the Kalam cosmological argument, which is a philosophical argument." He says, "And I don't think that argument has gotten any stronger recently. However, I think the argument to intelligent design is enormously stronger than it was when I first met it." Now, that is profound for him to say that, because intelligent design is kicked around. It is beaten up. It is abused in the academic circles. So he is really putting a lot of his credibility now as a leading atheist on the line by saying that. And eventually, Flew could not deny the significance of scientific evidence. In 2004 or so, Flew, compelled by evidence, set aside his atheist philosophy and embraced the belief that God created the world and that this God exists. And his belief is similar to a worldview known as deism or something like that. So it's not like the Christian God is what he holds to, but he holds to a belief that a God exists of some sort and created the world. And so at great risk to his personal legacy and his post-mortem esteem and legacy through history as one of the greatest minds of our time, in 2007 he published this book that you see there, explaining his conversion. There is a God, the no is crossed out, how the world's most notorious atheist changed his mind. And then he passed away in April 2010, and it was clear that Christian philosophy, Christian arguments, the original church life that he has as a boy, and even Christian charity could not sway him to believe that God exists. What finally made his position untenable was what? Scientific evidence. Science matters. Science matters. Scientific evidence is extremely significant for the case for God's existence. And the results of science can convince an atheist, even Antony Flew, to believe in the existence of God. Signs can be all that one's need, all that one needs to reject reject atheism completely. Now, if a big time shot like Flew could realize the significance of scientific evidence, even past his rigorous philosophy, and perhaps other skeptics can too in academia, and perhaps people in this room could too. And so that's all I am inviting you to do. If you're not a Christian in here, and you're a skeptic, you hold it to the atheist worldview, that's great. But all I'm asking for you in this class is to just consider what journey Flew went on as one of the world's leading atheists, and just see for yourself if you can't also consider what he considered. That's all I'm asking. Just consider what he considered. And so Flew said, follow the evidence wherever it leads, and it's the theist's burden of proof to show that God exists. So that's all I'm asking you to do. Follow the evidence wherever it leads, and let the theist show you the burden of proof, because he's making the claim God exists. So that's all I'm asking you to do. And this class, for the non-Christian, is not a debate forum. This class has a curriculum. But I invite you to come with your questions and just consider what Anthony Flew considered. Okay. Now, we have about 20 more minutes to 8:45. Are there any questions? We'll start the next section. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Well, science in high regard. My point would be that science has put itself there. It's not a matter of, like, my opinion that science is good, or collectively we have an opinion that science is good. Science has put itself there because science has given us the quality of life that we have today. Science has given us the ability to live to 89 years old, modern medicine. You know, the progress of the causal link between the scientific revolution, the Enlightenment, on down the road is that we have the lives that we enjoy today. I get to have a device that I can carry in my pocket that
anymore
in the world.
Yeah.
Or play Angry Birds. Or play Angry Birds. Very important.
But I think the point is that we, as Christians, have passively allowed science and scientists to speak outside of the wheelhouse. And I think that's kind of what you were addressing earlier. So just because someone has a PhD next to their name, if they want to tout their anti-theological views, people hold a higher credence to that than they would a layperson. And that's, I think, Jeremy, is that what you were getting at?
Essentially.
But you would argue that would fall under the premise of science. Science is a peer-reviewed, you come up with a theory, you test it, you try to disprove it, and then you publish your results, and then the rest of the community looks at that and then tries to disprove it themselves.
But science has never made a living cell from inert material, yet everyone lives. But much of the world touts evolution no longer as theory, but as evolutionary fact. Indeed, it is taught in schools today as evolutionary fact. No longer theory is applied, yet according to your own words, science has not proven evolution ever.
Hold on a second, because you're jumping ahead, which is awesome. But we're going to get to what you just mentioned. Let me go back to the first question, because you made a point.
Making a point that it's not just that we all agree that science is good, but that there's a plurality of opinion that science is good. It's that science has put itself in the position it's in because it works incredibly well at measuring predictability of reality.
Okay.
Every single time, and when it fails, it corrects itself automatically.
So where's the
okay.
question?
Yeah,
guys,
so
is there a question? It's not. You just want to talk about.
The formal question I would say: why do you characterize science as being lofted up popularly when there's lots of evidence that it's actually put itself there because it deserves it because it's so.
Okay, thank you. I think either way you phrase that, science has put itself there as an authority in society, or society has put it there. To me, that doesn't matter, because the end result is science is considered an authority by society. And we can talk about how that happened, and we are actually going to do that a little bit later. Talk about that enlightenment time in a few classes from now, yeah. So it's an interesting point you're making, but I think it doesn't affect much to us, because all we're saying is that it has that position, and that's the point. Whether society said, let's all put it there, or it's just, it got there indirectly, kind of what you're saying, subtly, just passively, whatever. It's okay. Now, did you have a question?
I actually do. So this is the part of this talk that you're giving is talking about using science to prove your point. What I'm wondering is, in Christianity, part of the core tenets is faith, right? Faith is very important in Christianity, right? So what I'm wondering is, how do you resolve the need for faith against the need to use science, which is inherently completely anti-faith?
Okay, so that's a great question. We, in the last year's class, talked about faith a lot, because it's very introductory. It's something that ought to be said at the introduction. So, without getting into this whole conversation about faith, yeah, it's this idea that Christians have of something called blind faith, which originated in the philosopher Kierkegaard, you know, a couple hundred years ago. That name may ring a bell to some of you. And Kierkegaard talked about blind faith, and he used Abraham as an example in the Bible when he was about to slay his son Isaac. He said, I'm going to do this, God, because I believe you have I believe you have provision. You're going to provide, God, and I'm just going to do what you said to do. So he goes to kill his son Isaac, right? And God stops him and gives him a lamb or ram or something. And later in the New Testament, that act was called an act of faith. And Kierkegaard later described that as a leap of faith, is what he said. And so Christians over time have captured that idea and called it blind faith. But that isn't biblical faith. Biblical faith is something that is probably better called seeing faith, something where I'm looking at evidence and I'm able to say that is something I am certain of, and therefore I can do this action because of it. And faith is always an active term in the Bible, and it's based on evidence. You can actually look, and it talks about that. Hebrews 11, 1 and 2, it defines that pretty clearly. And Christians just misconstrue it in our heads a lot. We talk about it terribly, and we start bouncing around this word blind faith. And so what I suggest Christians do is look into that a little bit further and understand that faith has its reasons, it's based on reasons, and Christianity is a reasonable faith, and it's not something that's blind like fairy tales and leprechauns, but there's actually some evidence that we hold on to, we stand on to, that's firm, and that helps Christians to say, I have faith in somebody, not faith of something. It's the difference between wish and evidence. Yes, sir.
Respectfully disagree with the premise that the story of Abraham is about faith. I mean, it's classically known as a story about obedience, but not faith. There was no understanding that God was or wasn't there. The story was God was there. God said to do something.
Yeah.
There was no doubt, and it wasn't that there was faith that anything would happen. It was that he knew his son was going to die in the story. That was the premise, because if he did have faith and he didn't think his son was going to die, then it wasn't a test at all. It was, the whole point of it was that he was going to kill his son because God said so.
That's right. And so, yeah, let me just respond real quick. It was an act of faith is what they called it in the Bible. So I'm
sure,
not.
But I'm saying I respectfully disagree with that terminology.
Okay.
It's
yeah, let me just say that the act of obedience, it doesn't make it not an act of faith.
True.
And so you're right, it is an act of obedience. But that's another sidebar conversation.
I was a child because I had faith that he was right and I was wrong, or I didn't know him better.
He knew better than me.
Yeah. Okay. I do agree with that.
Yeah.
In Romans, Paul said that Abraham's faith was reckoned to him as righteousness. So there is biblical documentation of that being a story of faith.
Yeah.
No, the same is faith, but it doesn't make it faith. I'm just saying that it's not. I'm saying it's not faith. I mean, the Bible says it's faith.
Okay.
I'm just saying.
Can we debate after class?
Okay.
And just say question. I mean, we ask the question. But
yeah, you guys could talk about that if you want. Yeah.
We can talk about that all day long.
Yeah. It doesn't matter between. Yeah, because between the story of Abraham and whether that you want to call it faith or not. Yeah, so let's try to stick to the topic, and that's what I would encourage you to do with this class, because you brought up evolution and stuff like that. And what I would do is write your question down on something and get to and bring that question up. Make a list of questions, because we are going to get to a lot of these awesome topics as we go. We have a lot of material. So when that material comes up, you're going to say, hey, I have a question from 5 weeks ago. Here it is, and you're going to be ready. And I guarantee you that's going to happen. So please, if you're going to bring up a question, just bring up a question related to the topic, and I'll give you a kiss afterwards. Okay, what's the other reason to talk about scientific apologetics? Christians need it. Christians need scientific apologetics. If you look at this little chart, it talks about our intellectual conflicts, uncertainty, and doubts. You can see that this chart shows the varying belief amongst Christians about life's origins and developments. We have uncertainty, we have doubts, and we differ from each other. And it's clear that some of this uncertainty, is clear here by the varying beliefs between Christians of all stripes. 55%. If you look at the evangelical Protestant line there, right next to it says 10, 25, and 55. If you look at that, it says over there to the right, 55 is the percentage of evangelical Protestants that believe that evolution has not occurred, meaning that basically animals have stayed in their present form since the beginning. 20% of evangelical Protestants believe that evolution has occurred, but was guided by a supreme being. 5% of evangelical Protestants believe that evolution has occurred, but do not know how. And 10% of evangelical Protestants believe that evolution has occurred by natural processes. So for evangelical Protestants, the total is 55% say that evolution hasn't occurred, and 35% say evolution has occurred. Okay? 55% say it has in some form, differing forms, and 55% say it hasn't, and 35% say it has in some form and differing forms. For the Catholics, it's a little different. 27% say that evolution hasn't occurred, and 65% say that it has occurred in some form. So it's clear that views on evolution vary between Christians of all different backgrounds. And as a whole, we're not really sure what to believe about evolution. We're very uncertain when it comes to asking a bunch of us. So we really need to get our act together here and educate ourselves. We got to figure this out, Christians. This has become a big loophole in our belief system. We kind of have some strange ideas, a lot of us, on this. And Christians are in conflict. We're conflicted. 48% of those who attend religious services at least once a week see a conflict in terms of evolution and the Bible. However, amongst those who attend worship services once a month or less, as well as those who rarely, if ever, attend, the perception of conflict runs even higher. So if you go to church less, you even see more conflict. Okay? And then those who don't even have a specific religious affiliation, like you just say, I'm a Christian, I kind of go to whatever church, or I don't go at all, whatever, those are more likely to perceive a conflict between science and religion. And 53% of Catholics and Protestants feel this way. And so this is a lot of us as Christians. 48 to 68% of people sitting in church on any given Sunday morning understand there to be a conflict between their beliefs and the results of science. That's a lot of people. So next Sunday when you're in church, look around and say, how much is 50% of this group? And then think to yourself that half of everybody in the room is thinking to themselves, when they think about these things, that religion and science are conflicted. Half of the Christians in your church. And then if you extrapolate that across the country, think of how many Christians that is. 50% of every Christian that goes to church is conflicted when it comes to science and religion. So Christians, we need to figure this out. We need to figure this out. Our beliefs, if true, and correspond to the actual universe, should be backed by science. If our beliefs are right, science should support them. Our Bible and entire Christian philosophy points to a God who created it all. But when pressed about it, many of us have a hard time articulating how the results of current science collaborate with this belief. Many Christians are afraid to dig in, afraid to really hear that Genesis and science don't match. We don't want to hear that. We're kind of scared, like, oh my God, if I look into this and I find that these rock formations or these fossil records disprove my belief that God created the world, what am I going to do? Ah, so I don't want to deal with that. So we say, I'm not sure. We try to take the higher road out and say, I'm withholding judgment because I'm sophisticated and I like to say, I don't want to make a judgment yet because I don't have all the facts. Well, you're not even looking into it. And so we know that there's some confusion we have because we haven't thought about it very well. We haven't thought it through. And we think that if we go deep enough, maybe something will contradict our belief. That's what a lot of us think. So we just kind of don't look into it. We're a little afraid. So many of us don't think about it. But I have good news for all of us. For the Christian, the evidence is in favor of that position, and in favor of that worldview. And what is lost in Christians not thinking about it is a great apologetic to strengthen our faith and enhance our worship in the Creator God that we have a relationship with. We lose that. We lose that extra foundation as Christians when we throw science out because we're a little too afraid to get into it. And so this class will attempt to strengthen that relationship and worship by giving you ways to think about science and faith, by exposing you to some hard scientific evidence. Younger Christians are being affected by this alleged hostility to science. And Barna Group, the polling agency that's highly respected, sought to understand why younger Christians are leaving the church. These results were published in a book and can be found online. And they found that there are six key factors that contributed to an overall loss in faith. And one of the six factors was that churches come across as antagonistic to science. And so here are some of their finds. This is what essentially the young people are saying. They're saying that Christians are too confident, they know all the answers, or churches are out of step with the scientific world that we live in, where they say that Christianity is anti-science. This is raw, off-the-cuff young people reaction, unfiltered. They think that Christianity, or some of them, 25% of them, think that Christianity is anti-science. And so furthermore, the research shows that many science-minded young Christians are struggling to find ways of staying faithful to their beliefs and to their professional calling in science-related industries. I work in engineering, and I can tell you there's Christians there. And I know for sure there's scientists who are Christians, and I don't mean the Tom Cruise types. And so this has to change. This young people's belief has to change. We have it better than this, and our young people need to know it. And they need to see the older Christians having confidence in their scientific worldview to present it articulately and eloquently. And we need to understand the church's, Christianity's, better positions when it comes to matters of science. Obviously, Christian belief varies across the board. But there are some good positions Christians hold that are really worth our while. And so younger Christians need scientific apologetics, and they need older Christians to show them the way. So if we are to have confidence and certainty in our belief system, both, if you're looking at this, you can skip the word are, both older and younger Christians need to understand the appropriate relationship between science and Christianity, the philosophy of science, and scientific evidence for theories. And so this class will attempt to provide material that will allow confidence and certainty for any Christian in the room, young or old. Now, we're going to skip this next section because I wrote that like at midnight. And nothing good happens after midnight. Okay. Questions at this point?
Page 15?
Yes. Confusion abounds. Why are we studying this now? Why, Jeremy, do you think it would be wise to have a class on this now? Well, confusion abounds, I think, now more than ever, and it's rampant. There is a difference between philosophy of science and science. And many people are confusing philosophy of science with science. And this affects their view of God or lack thereof. This confusion is everywhere. It's widespread. It's one of the most common and pervasive general population confusions of our time. I'm very confused about the Kardashians. You may be very confused about why I'm a Raiders fan. I understand. It's confusing. But this is something very confusing to a lot of people. Philosophy of science and science. There's a lot of confusion between those two things. And some people say only science could give us truth. But if you think about it, that's a self-defeating statement. If only science could give us truth, we could never know that only science could give us truth, because this is not something science could tell you. A self-defeating statement basically uses its own criteria to try to prove itself. And so in this sense, this thing can't be proven, so it's self-defeating, because science can never tell you only science can give us truth. And so this statement is very philosophical in nature. It's not a scientific statement. It's a statement of philosophy. And you might respond, what science experiment taught you that? Or what is your scientific evidence that only science can give you truth? Or give us truth? So these things are statements of philosophy. They're not statements of science. It's a statement about science, not a statement of science. And so there's a confusion that happens in the general population that philosophy of science and science are the same thing. And worldview statements such as this are the same thing as science. The results of the scientific method. There's something that an experiment told us. And philosophers of science are very smart. They're very, very smart. In fact, some of the brightest minds that ever lived in our world had philosophy of science in their plethora of philosophies. David Hume, Immanuel Kant, Thomas Kuhn, Paul Feyerabend, all these people, these are some of the more famous ones, these had all basically developed a philosophy of science. And Hume thought that any and all knowledge can only be obtained through experiment or experience. Basically, this is known as empiricism. And so essentially, he's making a statement about science. Kant said that we can't know things of God's realm through reason. And we can't know things of God's realm through experiment or experience, that is science. We can't use rationalism or the reasoning of cause and effect, or even experiences or empirical sciences to know that God exists. So Kant is saying, you can't reason your way to God, and you can't even use science to get to God. That's a statement and a philosophy about science. Of course, it was much more elaborative than that. I'm just trying to summarize volumes of his work in one statement. I can't do that. But he's making statements, or he's trying to develop ways to think about science. And so philosophers of science provided entire philosophical systems for thinking about science while addressing these questions. They wrote volumes on this stuff, guys. Volumes. I mean, these guys were geniuses. And we have philosophers of science with us today, and they're not respected as they should be. But again, they're not scientists. They're trying to determine answers to these questions. Does the universe actually exist? Is it real? That's kind of one of the questions that a philosopher of science will try to understand and answer. They ask questions and try to answer how to understand the universe, how to test it. How to test our test. What is a theory? Could this theory be falsifiable? Meaning, could somebody prove this theory wrong? If I have a theory that's not falsifiable, I shouldn't hold that theory. My theories all should be falsifiable. Paul says that if Jesus did not raise from the dead, then our faith is in vain. It's futile. It's worthless. And what Paul is doing, he's saying, if you can show, or if Jesus didn't actually rise from the grave, if he's still dead, then Christianity is based on nothing. And we are to be pitied amongst all men, Paul said. We're to be pitied the most because we believe a lie. That's what Paul said. So what Paul is saying is that our belief system hinges on that one event in history. And that's a falsifiable event. Somebody could prove that false by finding Jesus' body. And of course, at this point, it would be withered away, but say at the time the body was somewhat intact, and we could all look at it and say, oh yeah, he's dead. But that didn't happen, and so let's move on. Our presuppositions guiding the hypothesis. Are my presuppositions guiding the hypothesis, the formulation of the question that I'm seeking to answer? Can someone be a neutral observer? That's a question that philosophers of science try to answer. Can someone be a neutral observer? Are observations theory-laden? Are these results relative to me, or to us, or to just planet Earth? If I did this experiment on Mars, would it be different? How much does science tell us about reality? That's what philosophers of science ask and answer. What counts as facts? What is a law of nature? What is a law of nature? That's a question of philosophy, not of science. Science finds laws of nature, describes them, evaluates them, tests them, such and such. Can a law of nature be suspended? Can a law of nature be stopped? Some people define miracles as a suspension of a law of nature. I think that's a terrible way to define miracles. What are the boundaries of scientific knowledge? These questions are about science and cannot be answered by science. And so philosophers are trained and educated and experiment and experienced in generating these systems of ideas about science and answering questions regarding the limits and influences and influence of science. And these are the guys that we want to go to when we're asking these questions. So there's a big difference in the question, can science prove a creator exists? And does science prove a creator exists? There's a big difference in those two questions. The philosophical question is the first one, can science prove a creator exists? The scientific question is, does science in fact prove a creator exists? Those are two different questions. And I'm not a professional philosopher, I'm very amateur, and some sort of layman apologist, whatever you want to describe me as, but I love philosophy. And the answer yes or no to can science prove a creator exists, the answer yes or no to that, doesn't matter if science does prove a creator exists. And so this is what happened with Antony Flew. It wasn't that his answer to the question, can science prove a creator exists, was yes or no. It didn't matter. Because at the end of the day, he saw science did prove a creator exists. And so if science does prove a creator exists, then the answer to the first question, can science prove a creator exists, is yes. If I say Johnny can't jump over the rock, and then Johnny goes and does jump over the rock, then he can. And that's the point of this. The delineation of philosophy of science and science will be the theme of this class. We are going to understand these two questions and try to answer them separately. Can science prove a creator exists, and does science prove a creator exists? And we need to understand the difference between them. And so in this class, there will be ample time to given to understanding of the scientific philosophy of many people. And you can cross out the word "and." And last thing I want to do is pass this out, and I'll let you go. But I want you just to look at this. I don't know if there'll be enough copies. And we're a few minutes past, but we started like 15 minutes late. So if you will just forgive me. It's about 8:45, which is about time to go, but we started a bit late. So if you can just look at this with me, and what I'm asking you to see here is that in general, there are two different worldviews: the naturalistic worldview and the supernatural worldview. And these two worldviews, oh yeah, thanks. These two worldviews are very common in our society. A lot of people have one of these worldviews. It's one or the other usually. And what you can see here is if you look at the naturalistic worldview, it goes from the universe essentially develops from simple to complex. But in the supernatural worldview, the universe develops from complex to simple. And in the naturalistic worldview, the universe goes from disorder to order to disorder again. Whereas in the supernatural worldview, it goes from order to disorder back to order again. People call that heaven or God's kingdom coming, that sort of thing, when it comes back to order again. In the naturalistic worldview, matter produces mind. In the supernatural worldview, mind, God, produces matter. Natural, the basic structures of life that create life go to a greater level of intelligence. And in the supernatural worldview, it's the reverse. Intelligence, greater intelligence, produces these basic structures for life. In the natural worldview, the universe self-creates. Supernatural worldview, an agent creates it. I'm not talking about a CIA agent or FBI, a free agent. In the naturalistic worldview, the universe self-organizes. In a supernatural worldview, an agent organizes it. Natural, subjective meaning, values, and ethics, and justice is our framework for our worldview. In the supernatural worldview, people hold to a objective meaning, values, ethics, and justice. And in the naturalistic worldview, the immaterial entities and beings are impossible. Those are impossible in the naturalistic worldview. In the supernatural worldview, immaterial entities and beings are real and endure through time. And I'm showing you this right now just so you can kind of have a glimpse of what we're going to get into in the next few weeks. We're going to be looking at these, the naturalistic worldview in detail. We're going to be talking about it, talking about the philosophy of science that generated this through history. We'll go back to the Enlightenment a little bit, look at some of the first people that developed ideas on empiricism, scientism, naturalism, and look at that and show the different problems with the naturalistic worldview as a philosophical system. And then later on in the class, we're going to get into this, to the science itself, and look at some hard sciences, biochemistry, astrophysics, cosmology, and classical physics as well. And then later on, we're going to get into Christian views on the universe and origins of humans and things like that. And so we'll talk about old Earth, young Earth stuff kind of towards the end. And I'm giving you that quick structure right now. I have a detailed structure for you that we're going to get into. I didn't want to give that all to you right now. The point of this class was to just give you a glimpse of stuff to provoke thoughts and help you start this journey with me. So why don't we close in a quick word of prayer, and then we'll be dismissed. Father, we thank you so much for this class and the time we have together. We pray that you would bless us as we leave and help us in our minds to think well about things and guide our thoughts. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you. Yes?
Suggestion, if you're taking a notebook, everybody should maybe write your name on the first page in your notebook, because we've had people leave notebooks behind and it's impossible to tell them to get it back to
you. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, you're dismissed. Thanks.